Anybody else sort of feeling blah today? Or just when you guys feel blah, you can go watch me on video. When I feel blah, I still got to be here putting up the video. But I feel, is it the weather? Is it the midterm blahs? It's the weather? Okay. Well, there we go. Hi there. This is lecture, well, who knows what I got wrong today because I'm feeling blah. But I think it's lecture 15, October 19th, lecture notes page 127. And if you know anyone from India, they're Indian, you can wish them a happy Diwali holiday coming up on Monday. That's the Indian Festival of Lights, a very pleasant holiday among that cultural group. This Friday is the thing we've been seeing for about forever, about helping out to build some bags for the food pantry patrons. Wouldn't hurt to help that group on the 21st. Test results, mini test 6 closed last night. Average score 89%, and 95% of the students took it. And as you know, 7 is open on the regular Tuesday-Saturday schedule, closing on Saturday, so it's up and running. Enhanced learning extra credit number 5. I think I misspoke before break. It does not open until the 20th. And that's tomorrow, and it'll run for a week. So we had an off week due to the winter break, so that will open up them. How many people know and like Coldplay? A couple folks, okay. So Coldplay is partnering, do you guys know DHL as a logistics and transportation company? Is that something you know? Yeah. So they're partnering with DHL for a sustainable tour that matters. Back in November 2019, Coldplay announced it wouldn't tour again until it could make the process of touring not only sustainable, but actively beneficial to the planet. Wow, that's an interesting claim for a musical, live, you know, for a music group. The results, the band's Music of the Spheres tour, marks a new live model for brands and artists, one that promotes sustainability for the very near future. So here's the importance of sustainability in the mix, even if you're an artist. Why is sustainability so necessary for the music industry? In the UK alone, the British Arts Council estimates that live music produces almost 450,000 tons of greenhouse gas emissions each year, something Coldplay didn't want to exacerbate. I digress a little bit to say, in my youth, I was involved in the theater. Some of my peeps stayed with the theater. So one of the guys that I know was the stage manager down here at Blossom. So I called him up on the story, and I asked him, you know, what did he think as somebody who works in a union doing stage stuff for these kind of things? He went into a whole rigmarole about it. But he said when the trucks would come in for the shows, and they could have 5, 6, 7 trucks loaded with stuff, they would just leave their diesel motors in the trucks running the entire show. And he said the reason was that's where they stay. The truckers stay there. They live there. That's where they hang out during the show. And he said that was not, you know, he'd say something about pollution. They said, no, it's not doing anything. Meanwhile, there are, you know, plumes of black diesel smoke coming out of these things. So he was on board with this idea at a personal level down here at Blossom. Anyhow, the band have committed to reducing CO2 emissions by 50% compared to previous tours and will also offset the event's carbon footprint by funding different rewilding and renewable energy products. Yay for them. That's authentic. To support the complex logistics needed to take the tour from city to city, Coldplay has enlisted DHL, its official sustainability partner. The collaboration is not only pioneering a new model for the live music industry, it's also ushering in a new dawn of collaboration between brands and artists that go beyond sticking a logo on a ticket stub. So a bit of brand partnership there. Dirk Udy, head of global advertising at DHL, said the company's ambition to become a leader in sustainability marries perfectly with Coldplay's vision to create a touring blueprint that works better for the planet. He's hoping the lessons from this tour will help the brand deliver best practices for other artists to build on and push the live music industry towards an ultra-low carbon and sustainable future. So actually innovations in, this is a channel of distribution for live music, in a live tour channel of distribution. While Coldplay's desire to deliver sustainable tours stem from their personal morals, 82% of music fans versus 72% of the general public said they were concerned about climate change too. Therefore, the need for sustainable tours relates to audience and consumer desires as well as Coldplay's personal morals. However, 64% of gig-goers said they are unaware of any green campaigns within the music industry, so there's a gap in the market. So ethics in marketing and satisfying consumers as well with ethics. Coldplay will work with scientists from the Grantham Institute for Climate Change and Environment at Imperial College in London to quantify the impact that changes make. So there's research to evaluate the results. And I didn't go all the details of what they're doing. DHL is using electric trucks. The stage is generates electricity. If you move around on it, it's generating electricity. The LED things that people wear are made from bamboo and sustainable, all sorts of interesting other things that I didn't get into here as part of their sustainability effort. Yay for them. Kava. Anybody know Kava? You do? How do you happen to know it? I mean, is it around here? Is it out there? No, so you've seen it elsewhere in the country? Yeah. So Kava rebrands itself with sun-kissed look. Kava's rebranded its look and logo to seize on the rising interest in Mediterranean foods. So we're seeing them react to changing consumer tastes, one of the things marketers have to pay attention to. Earlier this month, Kava launched three new menu items: sweet and spicy chicken pita, balsamic date chicken bowl, and balsamic date vinaigrette. So new products in their mix. The new look comes as Kava is expanding. The 11-year-old brand expects to open 75 new stores this year, with a total of 250 locations by the end of 2022. Kava is expanding to new markets such as Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, and Oklahoma, and expanded its presence in New York, Texas, and Washington, D.C. So we're seeing their growth strategy through an approach called market development, which is selling more of existing products out to new markets. The updates at Kava coincide with growth in Mediterranean food. When compared to other popular restaurant categories such as pizza, salad, and barbecue, Mediterranean cuisine has the highest consumer demand and the least available options in the fast casual dining category, according to Kava. So a bit of SWOT analysis. They find a match between their strengths, Mediterranean food, and the opportunities. There's not a lot of providers out there, and there's a growth in the interest by consumers. Kava designed a new logo. The thin black and orange signature logo is now replaced by the soft yellow with stretched letters and rounded edges, so they're refreshing the brand. Ads will run on social platforms such as TikTok and Instagram, and out-of-home placements in Washington and New York, city bike share stations, bus shelters, wild postings. Wild postings are street-level advertising where paper posters are pasted. Paper posted or paper post? Can you say that? Paper posters are pasted on the sides of buildings, construction sites, and barricades. So that's their media strategy. The brand rollout will continue into 2023 as Kava unveils a new store prototype, a new packaging for its line of grocery products. So Kava Mediterranean, there we go. This is going to get, although I like to think most of my marketing news and business news stuff is really spiffy and interesting, this gets a little draggy, but it's right on target with what we're talking about, which is how top brands use market segmentation to reach customers. And this is a fairly new published piece. A famous American editor, Herbert Schwope, once said, "I cannot give you the formula for success, but I can give you the formula for failure, which is try to please everybody." In business, that's not going to work. So top brands understand the wisdom of this. They know that marketing to everybody in a noisy and crowded world dilutes the power of their message, making it irrelevant and therefore easy to ignore. Rather, they use, yay, segmentation marketing to customize messaging based on customer needs, preferences, and other factors. Because the messages are more relevant, because you're dealing with a target who wants a particular thing, consumers feel validated, their engagement increases. When done well, market segmentation helps brands to avoid costly mass marketing techniques and enjoy a better return on investment on carefully targeted campaigns. As you recall, of course, because you remember everything I ever said, the segmentation process is good because it's more efficient use of your marketing budget, your marketing elements, and this is a guy talking about exactly that. So with market segmentation, you can consolidate and sharpen customer pain points. You can zero in on your customer's most pressing problems, such as easy, affordable access to essential products or services, or their interest in, I forget what my example was last time, fashion or technology or low price. What's their pain point? Simplify messaging to make it more relevant. Customers respond to clear, direct marketing messages that prove you understand their pain points and can help address their problems. Build effective marketing campaigns. You can create targeted campaigns and identify the best channels to reach your particular audience, whether it's some particular form of social media or events or content marketing or digital advertising because you know who that target segment is. Attract high-quality prospects. Properly targeted messages draw in ideal prospects who in turn make ideal customers. They're high value, they're repeat buyers, they share messages with others and share offers with friends and family. You can stand out from the competition. The more specific the message is, the less it sounds like everybody else's. Message is based on the needs and attributes of a specific market segment, a specific target audience, stand out. You can deepen customer loyalty. When brands know what their customers value, want, and need, they can create offers and messages that incentivize those customers to come back and buy again. Why is it more important than ever in 2022? Customers have become more protective of their personal data. As you know, platforms such as Google Chrome and Apple are making the historic choice to phase out third-party cookies that let marketers track you wherever you go. And regulations such as the General Data Protection Regulation Act are cracking down on invasive data collection methods. So many marketers who previously relied on these third-party cookie sources are struggling to gather enough customer data. So here we're seeing the impact of changing social norms and regulations on marketing. But customers still crave a high level of personalization. This means it's time for marketers to turn to more privacy-friendly forms of data collection, namely first and zero-party data, getting your consumer segment, consumers in your target audience, to opt in to your stuff and share their data with you directly. Fortunately, customers share zero-party data directly and willingly in exchange for something of value, making high-quality, high-intent, highly effective at driving individualized marketing campaigns for specific target markets. So again, not that exciting, but it goes directly in a modern post to our course topic of the day, which is, of course, STP, segmentation, targeting, positioning. So we're going to pick up with lecture notes page 127, which is page 243 in the textbook. And let's see if I can find where we left off in. So now I have to go figure out where we left off. Thank you. So I was talking about demographic targeting products by age, and I was using the toothbrush example. Somebody was kind enough to send me from their childhood memory, toothpaste, fuzzy bear toothpaste for kids or whatever it was. Did you send it or you know it?
I sent it.
You sent it. Thank you. So again, another example of there's adult toothpaste. It's not that different, but we target it by age to another target audience. Oh, I know where we were. So I was talking to you last time about this Claritas Prism segmentation and went over this part of it. So let me bring up this slide. And now we're going to hear a little video on how Claritas works with these various neighborhood and segments. Let's see if it works for us.
Population becomes more diverse and affluent. Demographic researchers are changing the way they define segments of American society. The marketing research firm Claritas has defined 14 distinct groups of consumers based on recent census and consumer data that emphasize income, age, and lifestyles. Segments of each group buy the same type of cars, read the same magazines, and watch the same television shows. USA Today looks at Columbus, Ohio, where the demographic landscape matches the spectrum of groups seen across the nation, from the young digerati in urban Columbus, to the Beltway boomers who live in the burgeoning suburbs, to the bright lights little city living in small towns, to the greenbelt sports living outside the burbs. We interviewed residents within these groups. Click on a button to hear what they have to say. How would you personally define a green belt sport?
We are in the green belt sports area of Columbus, Ohio. And we're excited, actually, to live up here. I think green belt sports to us, I think, fits because we're a sports family. And we like to attend all the sporting events in Columbus. And we like to go to as many sporting events as we can. And all of our kids and family participates in sports.
And how do you feel about being categorized as one?
Fits the community pretty well. I would say that we're demographically a pretty conservative community, conservative values, patriotic, big parades during 4th of July, things like that. It's a fun place to live, a lot of activity, a lot of friendly people.
In your own terminology, how would you like to be defined?
I don't think anybody really likes to be pegged into a particular category. I don't like the green belt part means. The sports part is certainly, there's no question that that fits, I think, this community. Just a lot of great adults and kids that that participate in sports. So I'd say we fit into that category real well and don't really mind, I suppose, being placed in that category.
How would you personally define a young digerati?
I would define a young digerati as someone who lives in an urban environment where digital devices make a big difference in how they live their lives.
I would define a young digerati as someone who has too many digital devices to the point where the devices are actually ruling your lives. I don't know if we could survive without our TiVo and our Palm Pilots anymore.
How do you feel about being categorized as one?
I think the people they're calling young digerati are the people who used to be Generation X, and Generation X was just too overused. So now we're the digerati.
In your own terminology, how would you like to be defined?
In my own terminology, I would call myself as a young, professional, Asian American. I wouldn't refer to myself by the things that I buy.
I think it's interesting that they are trying to define us by the things that we buy when it used to be defined by a time, and I think that that's indicative of the time we live in, that we're nothing but a market segment now.
Well, yes, again, to marketers, you're a market segment. That makes sense. And so I don't know, does anybody know the Columbus area? Can you relate to these neighborhoods and these types of people, perhaps, as we were talking last time about, I don't know, Beechwood versus Ravenna, having different types of people in terms of neighborhood? You could categorize them differently. Sometimes this works. We can actually look up. So somebody give me a zip code that isn't right here and is not Columbus. Give me a zip that you know. Yo. 14051. So let's see what this pops up to be. 14051. First of all, we'll see if I got it right and it gets it right. And then we'll see if you recognize anybody who's tagged in this area. So it looks like this is East Amherst-ish. Is this near East Amherst? So in this general area, they would have Country Squires, Gray Power, Winner's Circle, Movers and Shakers, and Upper Crust. This does not sound like a blue-collar area to me. Let's take a look at one of these folks. Let's take a look at Gray Power, a little more, if it'll do a little more specific stuff for it. So what does Gray Power tell us in this particular part of the world? Well, you can see about how many U.S. households there are that are categorized this way, 1.4 million. The median household income, what's the average income in the United States today, would you guess? About what? Webbies? Okay. Anybody? What? 55 to 60,000 is the average income today. These guys are in 151, double that, more than double that. Suburban, wealthy, what are their assets? They're millionaires. Interestingly, the household technology is somewhat below average because they're older. They don't have kids, why not? They're already in the family life cycle where the kids are out of the house, right? And education levels are graduate plus. So this is stereotypically, like I talk about sometimes, they own a Cadillac, they eat at a Bonefish Grill, they shop at Chico's, they attend PGA, LPGA events, they cruise on Royal Caribbean, they visit cruisecritic.com, they listen to adult standards. The point about this is as you begin to better understand folks in that particular geographic area, it should begin to suggest things about how you would market to them, yeah? Does this speak to you at all in terms of folks you know? Not at all, not the folks you know. All right. Well, then we'll have to send in a critical note to the folks over at Claritas and tell them to get their act together. Anybody else have a burning desire to look up their area, or we're good? All right, hold on. Let me do one more. Say it again.
23901.
All right, let's see if it resonates with you at all, or if you too say it doesn't sound like folks I know. So this appears to be?
Virginia.
This appears to be Virginia, where we have the back country folk, the red, white, and blue segment, country strong, lower mid-scale, middle-aged family mix, and the young and rustic, the low-income, middle-aged, mostly without kids. Does that resonate with you in terms of what you would picture generally in that area?
Yeah.
Yep. So, and again, you can picture you'd have a different media mix, you'd have a different set of models, you'd have different verbiage to this segment, these segments, than you would to the one we just saw, right? It begins to help the marketers to picture who these people are and how to advertise to them. You can, for money, get a lot more depth than we have here. All right, so people in each segment buy the same type of cars, read the same type of magazines, and watch the same TV shows, websites, etc. We also can talk about behavioral segmentation. For example, what features do people buy? How do they behave in terms of a feature? For example, CityCard has a variety of products offering different benefits that people seek out and want to buy. Rewards, establishing credit, small business benefits, no-frills value cards. So they've been able to segment a piece of plastic to different target populations based on what people are looking for in terms of the purchase of that card. Here's the City Premier card, the Custom Cash card, the Costco Anywhere card. You can browse their cards for rewards, for travel, 0% intro APR, cashback. And they have a whole series of cards here based on how people behave with, interact with their cards, right? Behavioral marketing. We can talk about the usage rate. Are there people that just don't use your product? And is there any way to get them to use your product? Or are they just off the screen? I think we talked one time about vegetarians. They're just not going to buy my tasty steak, no matter how I advertise to them. But what about your light, your medium, and heavy users? Less than 50% of all users account for 80 to 90% of sales for many, many product categories. I think we said last time when I last heard about cola, 80% of their sales done through 20% of their customers. So you have to know who they are and not piss them off. For example, Best Buy did research and found that 20% of their customers generated the bulk of their profits by buying high margin items without a bunch of rebates. They just go in, they buy, they're done, they're paying full money. On the other hand, there's a group here, I've called them the devils, I guess. They're a drain on profits. They shop only for bargains, they utilize the rebates, they often return merchandise, they suck up the salespeople time and then go online and buy instead of buying from Best Buy. Who would you want your people to identify, your salespeople to identify and spend time with? A, obviously, you'd like them to spend time up there with the angels. So employees are trained to identify angels and give them special attention. Not that they ignore everyone else, but, you know, if you're buying full-time, full price, expensive items, let's give you a little more attention, right? So based on that sort of segmentation, we train our employees on who to spend extra time with. We can do a combination approach. So market segments can be created by using several bases together. So for example, we can combine gender, a demographic base, and lifestyle. So you're talking about female runners. For example, people that enjoy the outdoors and want to run, and they're women in particular. That could be a magazine, that could be a website, that could be a bunch of clothing or equipment, right? The next example, geographic and consumer intentions, which is a behavioral.
What we do is
we're going to hear from Shane Dutka talking about his work in affiliate marketing, etc., and how he's focused on what people want, their intentions to buy, and a geographic area of the country.
What we do is we create segments of types of keywords people will be Googling. For example, best home warranty in Mississippi, best home warranty in Nebraska, whatever. Those are segments. and have a certain intent. We'll create content around that, publish it on our websites. Google will rank it. People will show up and they'll click our links and they'll go and buy home warranties. We'll make money. Now there's other segments like best home warranty for plumbing. That's a whole different intent, and the user, the people who are Googling stuff, have different needs, and we bucket those in segments differently. So like best home warranty for plumbing, best home warranty for HVAC, those are two segments in the umbrella of home warranty affiliate marketing.
So it depends who you want to represent. It depends what's hot in the market right now. It depends what area of the country they're in. So we're combining the idea of geographic and their behavioral basis, what they're out there looking
for. Well, we do.
So we're talking about segmentation, looking out and breaking up that big group of people into folks that have common needs, wants, and desires that are different than other people's needs, wants, and desires. We thought about identifying who they are and then how we might begin to create messages for them. So now we're going to talk about the idea of targeting. One approach to target marketing is what's called market aggregation or mass marketing or undifferentiated marketing, which sort of flies in the face of what I'm talking about, but that's okay. Here we're going to use a single marketing strategy for everybody. Some products it'll work for, but you can't satisfy everybody with a single marketing mix. But nonetheless, some people just use this mass market appeal. These days, I don't so much love the idea of a shotgun approach because too many places people are actually shooting at you with a shotgun, but it's just blasting away at the group of potential customers and hoping that you, quote, hit someone with your marketing mix. It's pretty uncommon, but you might think about some commodity products that are sort of aimed at everyone. What's your favorite? Well, first of all, does everybody know what that upper right-hand thing is, what the right-hand image is? Do we know what it is? Clothespin. Well, I'm not sure what people know these days. I mean, how often do we use clothespins? What's your favorite brand of clothespin? It's a clothespin. It's a commodity product. If I used it, I probably don't care about the brand. There, mass marketing might work. Just send your brand out, send your product out to everybody. But even gasoline, which is pretty commodity, comes in different octanes for different groups of people. So even there, they have a bit of segmentation in what they're selling. Why might you think about doing this? Well, you get lower costs overall. Again, operations people, people in manufacturing love long production lines of the same thing over and over again, the same size, the same shape, the same color, because constantly the unit cost of making those things goes down. There's not a lot of changeover. You don't have a lot of excess inventory. You don't have a lot of waste. People know what they're doing. They've learned how to make it. So you get lower costs due to long production runs. Then you don't have to inventory up 5, 6, 7, 8, 20 different types of colors, shapes, sizes. It's all one thing, lower inventory costs. And it's easy to manage. So all you're doing is managing the marketing mix for one thing, whatever it is you're focused on, to everybody. Pretty simple. If you can be successful, great. A different approach is any one of a number of product differentiation strategies. Product differentiation involves using different elements of the marketing mix, product place, price, promotion, to help consumers see the product as being different from the competition and better for them because it understands their pain points, it understands their problem, it understands their interests. Fashion, technology, low price, because that's the segment you're targeting with your marketing mix. To create a perception that the brand is, quote, better than PCs, Apple used a successful differentiating marketing strategy to point out how much better it was than PCs. I used to have a... I guess not. All right, so... yeah, so obviously, are you guys old enough to remember the battle between PCs and the Mac? And the one guy was the stuffy old guy, and he represented PCs. And the other was a younger, hip guy, and he was representing Macs. And they would banter with each other over which was better. That was sort of this approach. We can do a single segment strategy or a concentrated targeting approach. So the notion here is that we do go out and do the work of coming up with different segments. So we're not just having a single marketing mix for everybody. We see the folks in fashion, we see the folks in technology, we see the folks in low cost, and we say, we're not going to try to market to everybody. We're going to focus on the technology group and concentrate on them and let competition have other people. So it's one marketing mix to a targeted, defined group of people, and it can be a good way, as we chatted with last time about the tea company, to avoid competition. When Volkswagen first came out a long time ago in the U.S., anybody remember know what they were calling that? The nickname was? The Bug. Well, the Bug, yeah, okay. It was called the Bug, among other things. And their notion was they were not coming out with all different shapes, sizes, models. They weren't coming out with a two-door, a four-door, a pickup, a van in the early days to get into the U.S. market. They focused just on the inexpensive, small car for that segment of the population. That was their initial strategy. Of course, strategies change over time, and they indeed now offer much more than just that original Bug, and those are all different sorts of VWs. So they change their strategy over time, but it was initially a good way for them to avoid competition and get in among a small segment. Ferrari, on the other hand, continues to concentrate on their original single segment. You can't find, as far as I know, a Ferrari SUV, a Ferrari four-door, and a Ferrari pickup truck. If you can, let me know. But I think they still have a single segment approach. And if this works for you, you can earn a reputation as an expert or a specialist in the niche. When you think expensive sports cars, I'm pretty sure one of the brands that comes to mind is Ferrari. They would be considered an expert in that small niche. Niche markets are often, though not always, relatively small. So it's not like you're going to ramp up mass production. Anybody a paintballer? Any paintballers here? You do paintball? So you went out and with a group and you did paintballing.
Yeah, but we paintballed when there were people that like zombies.
Oh, zombies. Let's shoot the zombies. I like that idea. So one company that has a passion for paintball was a company called Spyder. And so Spyder had everything you'd want in paintball equipment. Let's see if Spider's still out there for me. Come on. So they had the guns, they had the ammunition, they had the protective gear. Come on. There we go. And so if you want something in paintball, they may have been bought out by now by Fenix, but these guys have it for you. And of course, this is, there they are, Spider. These guys are, of course, it's a sport, right? And they have a passion for paintballs. Part of the core family of outdoors, all that is paintball. So this is one way for a firm that has limited resources to be competitive. Now, let's broadly consider this company as in a fun sports field. Can you think of any other companies that are in a fun sports arena? Who else operates with sports stuff?
NFL.
Yeah, but I'm thinking on the B2C, on the consumer side. Yeah. Wilson. Does Wilson make volleyballs?
Yeah.
The answer is yeah. Do they make basketballs? Do they make baseball gloves? Do they make baseball bats? Do they make sporting golf stuff? Do they make tennis? Yes. Do you want to go head-to-head against Wilson if you're a little company? No. Wilson is not, as far as I know, making paintball stuff. And this company would be silly to say, hey, let me go start making competition with Wilson. You have a limited resources. You have a niche area. People are interested in what you want, a segment. And you can be successful without worrying about going head-to-head against Wilson, right? Yes?
Dick's Sporting Goods?
Dick's would also be one that's not a manufacturer but sells all of these different sorts of Wilson and other products, right? You wouldn't want to go head-to-head against them very easily. Rawlings would be another one. Do you want to go head-to-head against them? Probably not. So this is a way for a firm with limited resources to be competitive. Find that niche that you can satisfy given your interest and your expertise and your resources. Now, a danger is that, of course, you are putting all of your eggs in one basket. What happens if paintballing totally falls out of favor? Well, you can't fall back on basketballs and volleyballs and baseballs. That's all you're doing. And I don't really know, do people paintball in the wintertime? I imagine those things become lethal weapons. Indoor, all right. Well, you're not going to do much outdoor. So this is my silly example of putting all your eggs in one basket. Anybody remember the World Football League? Most people don't remember it. It no longer was around. If you invested heavily in that, it didn't work for you. How about the DeLorean car? Yeah, right. Anybody watch Back to the Future? Okay. So the DeLorean car, didn't work out. Right now it's a collector's piece. Orbitz soda. Any remember Orbitz soda? Came and went. So not all niche marketing approaches work out for you. All your age in one basket, when things don't work out, you're gone. So you might say, well, I understand that. Maybe what I want to do is hit a couple segments up. So this is the idea of a multiple segment strategy. So again, we've done the work, we've done the segmentation work, we've looked out to our various potential populations, we've broken them up into different groups, and we say, wait a minute, we can do two or three or more of those segments. So we're going to identify multiple segments, we're going to develop, market, and manage multiple marketing mix offerings, and we're going to attempt to satisfy the needs, wants, and desires of each segment. We're trying to satisfy everybody with our marketing mix. This segment with our marketing mix. This segment with our marketing mix. This segment with our marketing mix. So we're using a targeted marketing mix approach to each one of these segments. For example, Bayer, aspirin, and more. I assume you've heard of Bayer. But Bayer markets Aleve and Bronchiate and Camphophonique and Citrucol and Donbrovoro and Fermerol and Flintstone and Vanquish and Bayer and Vactine and Midol. Different segments. They have multiple segments that they're focusing on. What are some advantages of this? Well, you can avoid seasonal demand. If you have both skis and tennis rackets, you can have one up, the other down. Dorm rooms, when don't we have a lot of demand for dorm rooms? Summer, okay. Anybody know what we do in the summer to make up for that loss of income with the dorm rooms? We have all kinds of camps, band camp, cheer camp, okay. So we sell these out to groups that want to do things in the summer. You also then become very well known in the product category as a leader, because wherever you go, there you are. Wherever the consumers go, there you are. On the other hand, imagine the inventory carrying costs Bayer must have for all the products we just saw, right? Or Wilson, imagine what their warehouses must look like. So you've got to have adequate inventories of each item, each color, each style, each shape, each size. Holy moly's. Got a lot of money tied up there. Then each segment, because they're different from one another, needs a separate promotional appeal. That gets expensive. You don't get a lot of economies of scale there. You're going to have higher distribution costs if each segment shops in a different place for those items that we're talking about. So you had better have pretty strong sales when you roll out a new product to a new segment. For example, it's estimated that each new version of Crest that they roll out needs about $100 million in sales, annual sales, to support it. I've never done the arithmetic, but that's a lot of tubes of toothpaste that you have to sell. So remember we talked about part of the segmentation strategy was, do you have enough potential demand? Numbers of people, dollars coming in, to make this thing work, because you're about to sink a boatload of money in this new product for this new segment. Urban Outfitters, we know Urban Outfitters, right? Yeah. Is a company that has a multiple segment strategy. So Urban Outfitters is a lifestyle retail company, operates in retail clothing stores. It operates through two reportable business segments, retail and wholesale. The retail segment consists of Urban Outfitters. How do you say that next word? Anthropology, Free People, Terrain, Leafs, Doter, and Beholden Brands, whose merchandise is sold directly through stores, catalogs, call centers, and websites. The wholesale segment consists of the Free People division. So we have two broad segments and then sub-segments within the consumer side. It designs, develops, and markets young women's contemporary casual apparel. So Urban Outfitters targets young adults, men and women, aged 18 to 28, through a unique merchandising mix, compelling store environment, websites, and mobile applications. Anthropology Group consists of Anthropology, Beholden, and Terrain. Anthropology's target market is women between the ages of 30 to 40, who are both affluent and individuals who want to reflect their unique style with what they wear. The brand goes beyond the surface and considers their target customer a friend. Anybody ever shop in such a store? Yeah? Do you feel that they treat you as though they're your friend or not really? Any more than anywhere else? Not really? Not really. All right. The Beholden brand emphasizes every element that contributes to a wedding. The brand offers a curated collection of heirloom quality wedding gowns, bridesmaid frocks, party dresses, assorted jewelry, headpieces, footwear, lingerie, and decorations, a different segment than the other two. Terrain is designed to appeal to women and men interested in a creative and sophisticated outdoor living and gardening experience, obviously different than the clothing lines. Terrain's product offerings include lifestyle home, garden, and outdoor living products, antiques, live plants, flowers, wellness products, and accessories. And Leafsdoter at Anthropology, artistic, timeless, and collectible. The Leafsdoter line is eminently wearable, although not pronounceable, bringing a modern dressmaker's sensibility to life through fine fabrics and tailoring, ornamented with extraordinary details such as unique trims, vintage buttons, and beautiful linings. Whew. Then, Free People. Free People is targeted at young contemporary women aged 25 to 30. A specialty women's clothing brand is the destination for bohemian fashion that features the latest trends and vintage collections for women who live free through fashion, art, music, and travel. There we are, being bohemian and living free. So it's a particular taste, a particular lifestyle, a particular market segment for this group. So they cover a lot of these different issues and more. Nuuly is their subscription segment, consisting of the Nuuly brand, which is a monthly women's apparel subscription rental service that launched in 2019. For a monthly fee, Nuuly subscribers can select rental products. It must be products. From a wide selection of the company's own brands, third-party labels, and one-of-a-kind vintage pieces through custom-built digital platform, subscribers select their products each month, wear them as often as they like, then swap into new products the following month. Subscribers are also able to purchase the rented product. Anybody doing a subscription-based fashion approach to life? Anybody know anybody else who is? Okay, not our segment. And then Menus and Venues. This division focuses on a dining experience that provides excellence in food, beverage, and service with 11 restaurants in the U.S. Quite a different segment from the other ones we've been talking about. And imagine what it means to say, okay, go manage that, that being all of it. Not a thing. You have different resources, different management expertise, different groups of people coming in, much more complex to manage this sort of thing. Levi's also runs segments for its jean products, focusing on Levi jeans here. Is that already in your notes? I always ask these questions and you have the answer. So when we think at the broadest level, what would you say the broadest level for Levi's segments would be? Any answer will do, but what do you think the broadest level is for Levi's jeans? I'll accept any answer. Blue jean, well, yeah. So you're right there. I mean, within the blue jean category, because, of course, they also do jackets. They also do other things. But within the blue jeans category, what would you say the broadest segment might be, segmentation might be? Yeah. Exactly right. Have you been in my class before? Oh, all right. See? All right. See? He's been in my class and psychically got the right answer. At the broadest level, you have gender differences. You have jeans for men versus jeans for women, right? But we would say that's too broad, because within those, you have different needs, wants, desires, and tastes that consumers have. And those are, for men, we can buy fit, loose, regular, slim, buy leg, boot cut, skinny, straight, tapered. So you can buy Levi's, mostly online these days, but they're still out there, from Sears. What do you pay for Levi's jeans, do you imagine? How much are they? $60? Does that sound right? $60 for Levi's jeans? Yeah, yeah. Because I haven't looked since inflation. But let's see if Sears is still there for me. And let's see what it costs for a pair of... That's Robux. How about our friends? So apparently you can buy jeans for $19 if you want. How about by brand? How about giving me Levi's? Let's see what we come up with here. Woo! So there's a nice orange pair of Levi's jeans for $52.59. Okay, you're right on target. $60, right? So here we have Levi's jeans out there in various cuts for around $60. Kohl's. Again, I've mentioned occasionally that they're one of my favorite places to shop, unless they don't give me what I want here with our friends Levi's. All right, so we're focused on men at the moment, so let's see what their Levi's men's look like and sell for. So Levi's, a little more expensive, $69.69. Looks like it's about a bit more expensive there. And Nordstrom. What do Nordstrom jeans sell for? Can we find Nordstrom Levi's jeans? These are women, which makes a little difference. So 50, 50, 50. Can we get men? Let's go with gender. Can we find men's Levi's? Just curious how they sell. 70, 90. Whoops. Nordstrom's. 50, 98. I don't think I saw that over at Kohl's. So we have some of the low-end stuff, and then we have our more normal price, which is a little more expensive, up to $100. How many people paying $100 for their jeans-ish? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. All right, and then, of course, we can look over on the women's side. Women, by waist, at the waist, high rise, just below the waist, low rise, ultra-low rise, skinny cut, leg cut, boot cut, flare, trouser. And then we have other brands, of course, that compete. So in different segments, we can buy some Armani jeans. What do those go for? Here's a regular fit, five-pocket trousers in cashmere and cotton denim for a mere $975. I don't show my wife this site much because... Or how about a nice regular five-pocket trousers in cotton and wool for, you know... $2,600. Well, I exaggerate. It's only $25.95. For an essence of a pair of jeans, targeting a different segment of the population, right? So, True Religion, Neiman Marcus, and a question, how can jeans cost $300? Well, how can they cost, whatever I just said, $1,200? So there are certainly different segments out there for blue jeans. On the other hand, there's mass customization for jeans. You can make your own jeans customized to your particular size. So you also can make custom suits, etc. But here we go, customize them to your size. You can choose all of the different things and get it in a mass customization sense. Or here's salvage jeans. They also will customize your jeans for you with fine craftsmanship and a good selection of thread color, buttons, your initials in laser, etc. And here's a very nice pair for $8,200 I don't know what B is. So if you want to customize your jeans, that's a different way to approach a segment. Mass customization for jeans.
We've segmented markets in a lot of different ways. The way that we're focused on primarily today is by, I'll call it industry. And so our whole business is focused on, as an example, primary metals, wind energy, power generation, cement, automotive, off-highway construction vehicles. And so we kind of divide the market up by how our product gets used and in the kinds of equipment and applications our product gets used. And within those market segments, then we can divide up the market even further, and that's the real challenge of marketing, is this micro marketing or micro segmentation to really understand within off-highway construction, as an example, are there customers that demand short lead time production? Are there customers that need longer life? Are there customers that are looking for more productivity? And again, going down to that level and trying to develop products and service offerings around that is a real challenge. It's actually been a very big focus of the Timken Company since about 2004. We've had a strong focus on strengthening our marketing capabilities in those areas I just talked about.
And so sometimes it seems simple. You would say, well, hey, in this industry, everybody must know these are segments. Well, yeah, sure, you do, but so does everybody else. That's not where the finesse comes at. Given what you do, who you are, your skill, your expertise, your competencies, what are the micro segments within here? People that want either a short lead time or a longer life. What are those people's pain points that you can do across the broader categories to have a unique selling proposition against competition for that segment? So it's not just, oh, those are the categories. It's a little more finesse, a little more work than that. So that's segmentation of the B2C
world. Going
back to the B2C world, I mentioned Bayer before. So Bayer employs 22,000 people worldwide. They're active in more than 100 countries, so it's global marketing. They have sales of over 4 billion euro, whatever year I put that together. More than 170 brands worldwide. Consumer Health headquarters is in Whippany, New Jersey. And Bayer Consumer Health's over-the-counter brands are manufactured around the globe in Europe, North America, and Latin America, as well as Asia. So again, a global company doing, of course, segmentation. If you look at the consumer care strategic unit, they have five major segments. They sell to the analgesic market with Bayer Aspirin, Aleve, Actrin, and Midol. They sell to the gastrointestinal segment with Alka-Seltzer, Lefax, Philips, Milk, Magnesia, Rennie, and Telcid. They do dermatological work with cough and cold remedies with Alka-Seltzer Plus and Aleve Cold and Sinus. And they sell in the multivitamin and dietary supplement area, including how many of you guys grew up with Flintstones One a Day? So that would be them. But it's a different segment than, say, cough and cold or dermatological. So in this particular division, they have five major segments that we're familiar with. And within Aspirin alone, remember I said subsegments, they have two subsegments, aspirin regimen and aspirin for pain relief. Well, we all know what aspirin for pain relief is. Anybody know what aspirin regimen would be, what that refers to? You're all too young to need it. So if you've had a heart attack, they want you to take low-dose aspirin all the time because it keeps your blood thin, keeps your blood from clotting, and so we have that as well. In some sense, they eventually overemphasized the fact that the product could be used as a cure for that. And I think I'm going to return to that, here, where a guy is on an airplane and he's asking the flight attendant if they have any aspirin, and they think he's having a heart attack. He says, no, it's just a backache. They may have overemphasized.
I had a heart problem. I was told to begin my aspirin regimen. I just didn't listen until I almost lost my life. My doctors, again, ordered me to take aspirin, and I do.
Be sure to talk to your doctor before you begin an aspirin regimen.
Listen to the doctor. Take it seriously.
So this is them building up that image of the product to be used for Heart Advantage. So even here we've got the low dose chewable and whatever that is, cherry and orange, and we've got the women's low dose with calcium and the sugar-free version and the safety-coated version, all of these as aspirin regimen. Here we have aspirin for pain relief. Well, duh, but back in body, extra strength, PM plus.
Body pain?
Oh.
Back pain? Try Bear Back and Body. It's Bear aspirin plus a special pain relief booster to relieve sore backs and soothe aching muscles fast. Get moving again with Bear Back and Body.
So they obviously advertise that, and I think here's my example where they may have overemphasized the aspirin regimen product.
Do you have something for pain?
I have Bayer aspirin.
I'm not having a heart attack. It's my back.
I mean Bayer Back and Body. It works great for pain.
Bayer Back and Body provides effective relief for your tough pain.
Better?
Yeah. Thanks for the tip.
So we're clarifying any confusion. We do both. We do the regimen, but we also do pain. We're an aspirin product. So they are obviously segmented in a variety of different ways. So let's think about some guidelines for selecting a target market. So we've gone, again, keep in mind what we're doing here. We've gone out, we segmented the market, we found a bunch of different people, a bunch of different pain points, different needs, wants, and desires that we might be able to satisfy, maybe. So before selecting a target market strategy among those various segments out there, you have to determine the desirability of each segment. For example, is that segment's needs compatible with our goals? We found a segment that wants to buy beer to drink over lunch while they're off their manufacturing job. Is that really what we want to be known for doing? Maybe it's not. Do we want to avoid selling to discounters like Walmart? Okay, well, then we're going to reach a different group of people in a different way through a different channel of distribution, but maybe that's not compatible with our image, with what we want to do. So, how desirability is a segment? Of course, is there a match between that market opportunity and our resources? Hey, yeah, we're doing paintball, but let's go enter the basketball, volleyball market against Rollins and against Wilson. No, that's not part of our mission, thank you. It's not going to work. So, not a good match between that opportunity and what resources we have. Black & Decker had an interesting situation. They bought GE's small appliance business. So Black & Decker at one time was known for tools. And then they bought the small appliance business. And the question was for them, how and where to market this new to us segment? Should we market it under the GE name, keep it that way? Should we market it under the Black & Decker name? What they decided was to go with a marketing approach where they already were. So their tools were well known at the Home Depot and Lowe's sort of thing, because they were selling tools. And they said, hey, let's ramp up and start selling through that channel of distribution to this market. Also, as you decide on a segmentation approach and a targeting approach, make sure that you have the profit available that justifies that investment. $100 million for each new type of toothpaste, better bring in some bucks. So the segment has to be large enough in terms of people and money. Should be something that's expected to grow. Let's not invest in a whole bunch of stuff in an area that's dying. We need to be able to reach that segment that we're about to choose at a reasonable cost, physically, with our message as well. And sometimes we have an interesting idea that just isn't going to pan out given what it's going to cost to make it work. I'm going to spin you back in time to the days of the early internet bubble before the bubble burst. There were all kinds of interesting concepts out there. One was, at the time, WebVan. WebVan was an online credit and delivery grocery business. It went bankrupt. It operated in 10 U.S. markets. It delivered its products to customers' homes within a 30-minute window of their choosing. And they had originally hoped to expand to 26 cities. But they were not associated with Kroger, Walmart Grossmies, Acme. They were going to have to stock up all the products they sold in warehouses that would allow them in each of these cities to deliver within 30 minutes. how many grocery items do you need to make this work? It's not 10 or 20, it's hundreds or thousands to make it viable. CNET, WebBand, is one of the greatest dot-com disasters in the history. What happened? The cost of processing, fulfilling, and delivering was $500 million per market. You aren't going to sell that much groceries. And so, realistically, they couldn't reach their target consumers with the process. So they couldn't build enough warehouses in enough places at a reasonable cost. Now, has the idea since they crashed come back? Yeah, but it's come back mostly with major grocery stores themselves offering this thing because they have the warehouses around. So updating the concept, DoorDash expanded so customers can now order groceries on demand from their local southeastern grocery stores, delivered in as little as 45 minutes through DoorDash's marketplace app and website. Uber Connect is now available in 6,000 cities and towns in the U.S., and their host of instant delivery startups, Joker, Bike, 1520, Fridge, No More, Gorillas, Getter. They promise extra fast, convenience store-style products directly to city dwellers' doors. The companies even say they'll arrive in 30, 20, 15, or 10 minutes after the customers hit the buy button, but they aren't ramping all this up from their own warehouses. They're making use of existing things. Also, let's pick a target market where the competitors are either very few, there's lots of opportunity, as we were talking about in the Mediterranean food, casual food industry, there's not a lot of competition out there. So it's weak competitors. So having segmented the market into those various groups and analyzed them to determine which and how many of those to target with appropriate marketing mixes, we're now going to think about how to position our brand for the target audiences. STP, segmentation, targeting, positioning. So positioning is creating and maintaining in the minds of our target market consumers a particular image for our brand relative to the competing products that are out there. When you think Sensodyne, how many people know Sensodyne toothpaste, the brand? What do you think of when you hear Sensodyne? What do you think of? Sensitive gums. It's not that hard. You don't think sexy breath. Maybe you think white teeth, I don't know. But Sensodyne comes to mind, I think for almost everybody, as sensitive teeth, sensitive gums. Yes, ma'am. Right. They've done a pretty good job of positioning their brand in the mind of the consumer, right? The name implies the benefit that it provides, Sensodyne. Its ads certainly are going to go beyond just suggesting the benefits, stating the benefits.
Since having the sensitivity, they want to get rid of it. They want to be out of pain. There's no reason to put up with the pain of tooth sensitivity. I recommend Sensodyne to my patients. Sensodyne helps with the sensitivity, plus it's great for fighting cavities. It freshens your breath. With proper brushing, it can help with your gum health. Sensodyne is definitely at the top of my list. It works, and it always delivers, and my outcomes are always good. What a difference that makes.
So obviously, this ad emphasizes what it does, what it is. So in combination with the along with the dentist recommendation, it's not just an ordinary toothpaste. It's not just going to make your teeth whiter, right? Anybody use Sensodyne because they have sensitive teeth other than me? Yeah, and if they don't have that in the store, do you just buy any old brand or do you go find Sensodyne? Yeah, I'll use Colgate as the sensitive version though. Yeah, because if you just use some other kind, man, that hurts. So consumers often form mental images of the brands, of the retail stores, of the products to help simplify their decision making. And as marketers, we want to help them to do that. Here's the thing, it's for you, Sensodyne. So what are the three steps in positioning the product? First of all, well, choose your positioning concept. And it should be the one that's important to the consumer, that deals with their pain points. In the case of Sensodyne, literal pain points, your sensitive gums, your sensitive teeth. So you want to answer the question, what will you do for me that other companies or products will not do, won't do as well? If soap leaves your skin feeling dry and tight, and you don't like that, could we come up with a product that might help out? Your skin be softer and moister. Well, Dove certainly did that. Dove contains 1/4 pure moisturizing cream and mild cleansers that leave skin clean and soft and smooth. Soap, on the other hand, contains drying ingredients that strip the skin of its natural moisture and leaving it feeling dry and tight. Is that, do you guys know Dove? Does that come to mind? A quarter pure moisturizing cream? Okay. Then, having decided what your message is, your concept is, design the features that convey that position. A quarter, whatever it was, cleansing cream, special Mediterranean food. Done well, this set of features is your unique selling proposition. That thing which you're going to do better than the competition to better satisfy that target market. Sensitive teeth, soft skin, good Mediterranean food, $3,000 jeans. Your unique selling proposition differentiates your product from the competitors on a feature that is key to those consumers. If I have sensitive teeth and you're selling me toothpaste that really freshens my breath but doesn't help my teeth, you're not helping me. It's not what I want. So you might have the lowest cost product out there. You might have the highest quality product out there. You might have the reputation for being the first ever of its kind, if your target market likes that idea. So USP can be thought of as what you have that competitors don't, that is of importance to your consumers. So what is it for your company? What is it that makes you special? Is it convenience? Is it low cost? Is it high quality? Is it status? Then coordinate all the elements of the marketing mix to convey that position. We're going to discover and satisfy consumer needs, wants, desires at a profit through an integrated effort of the firm. Make sure that all your messages are pushing Mediterranean, light Mediterranean food, sensitive teeth, expensive jeans. So target, this tagline might be expect more, pay less. That might be their position in the marketplace. The Peace Corps, their quote, the toughest job you'll ever love, makes them different than everybody else. M&M's, melts in your mouth, not in your hand. FedEx, the world on time and when it absolutely, positively has to get through overnight. Bounty, the quicker picker-upper. All of these catchphrases, all of these taglines are a shorthand for what they hope is the position they've created in your mind for this brand. And to the extent you go, yeah, it's working. To the extent you go, what? Never heard of that. Well, then it's not working very well. Or you're not in their target audience. Why am I putting Kay's Jewelers here? Because, okay, so I get what I'm doing. So when you think of Kay's Jewelers, do you know their tagline? What is it? Every kiss begins with K. K, I might not hit the note there. Every kiss begins with K's is something that comes to your mind and one of their positions, right? One of their positioning statements.
What's that? You got Mommy a Mother's Day present? From where?
Oh, nice. Oh, I totally agree. She's the best mommy ever.
It's beautiful. Dad, what's that? Give Daddy a great big kiss.
Every kiss begins with K.
Aw, so they couldn't go with style or luxury or innovation or status. Not their particular pitch to their particular audience. A bit of reasonably priced love. Victoria's Secret has been working to reposition its image, right? Reposition its brand in the minds of consumer. The largest lingerie retailer in the U.S. has been for several decades, total revenues in 2019, $7.5 billion. So they're still selling some undies here and there. It achieved explosive success in the late 90s and 2000s, but it's been accused of losing its relevance in recent years. Its 2020 revenues were $5.4 billion. So we're seeing here an impact on this well-known, well-positioned brand at the time of changing social norms. The company is currently overhauling its brand image and has abandoned its angels for activists and entrepreneurs representing their brand. So we're repositioning the brand in the minds of the consumers. In 77, the brand was created by Roy Raymond. It was a place where men would feel comfortable shopping for lingerie for women. The original idea, whether or not it's a true story, was he had gone to buy some lingerie for his wife. He was in this lady frilly, pinky lingerie shop, and he felt really uncomfortable. He said, how can men be expected to shop for lingerie for the women? Let me design something where men will feel comfortable. And he created a wood paneled environment. In June 82, Les Wexner, founder of Elle Brands, acquired Victoria's Secret 6 stores and his catalog for $1 million. So he was doing growth through acquisition and turned Raymond's vision on his head, creating a store that was focused on women rather than men, the one we're familiar with most recently. So he was repositioning that original brand. This repositioning worked. By the early 1990s, Victoria's Secret had become the largest lingerie retailer in the U.S. with 350 stores nationally and sales topping $1 billion. In 97, we had the Victoria's Secret Angel concept. Runway shows were growing to success. 2006 to 15, during CEO Sharon Jester Turney's tenure, the company thrived. Sales grew 70% to $7.7 billion. Between 2015 and 18, sales began to falter. Its market share dropped from 33% to 24% because Victoria's Secret was slow to adjust to a shift from padded and push-up bras towards bralettes, sports bras, missing out on a major fashion trend. Here's the importance, folks, of tracking and adapting to changes in consumers' needs, wants, and desires in your target market, in your target audience, and to changing social norms. So competition stepped in. More body-positive underwear brands such as Aerie, Third Love, and Lively cropped up, taking market share. The competition is always out there, and they're always willing to serve the consumer better than you are doing, can do, or want to do. In March 2019, an activist shareholder called out the company's brand image as being outdated. Victoria's Secret's brand image is starting to appear to many as being outdated and even a bit tone-deaf by failing to align with women's evolving attitudes towards beauty, diversity, and inclusion. It seems Victoria's Secret took this criticism to heart. It appointed two new female board directors and made steps to address the comments about the brand being outdated, hired a more inclusive model, body-inclusive model, Hungarian model Barbara Pavlin. It also hired its first openly transgender model, Brazilian transgender model Valentina Sampaio, celebrities in promotion. In the second half of 2020, the brand started to recover, boosted by more sales online. Jefferies analysts described Victoria's Secret progress as admirable after it reported strong fourth quarter sales in early 2021. The impact of changing strategies and changing positioning. It's also taking steps to overhaul the brand image, again, most recently swapping its angels for a new group of activists and entrepreneurial women to be the face of the brand. I'm restating myself there. I still have 2 minutes. Let me get through this. The notion of celebrating women's bodies with realistic spokespeople like Rapunzel and is departure from the over-sexualized marketing. So repositioning the brand using celebrity spokespersons and brand image. They gave competition the chance to come in. And they're talking about the younger generation really want to see themselves reflected. So we're going to have to stay tuned for the end result of their rebranding and repositioning. Okay, thank you for bearing with me. We'll do more next time. See you on Monday.